You're listening to Neurodiversity at Work.
Life can be so shady. The way some people try to bring you down. Why's it got to be so crazy? Always trying to give you the run over.
Welcome. You have landed at Neurodiversity with Theo Smith, co-author of the award-winning book Neurodiversity at Work and LinkedIn Top Voice. From heartfelt personal stories to enlightening expert insights, we will explore the world of neurodiversity and neuroinclusion, celebrating the uniqueness of diverse minds. Let's get on with the show. And welcome to another episode of Neurodiversity with Theo Smith and my incredible friends who come along and join me each episode to talk about their life experiences, to talk about sometimes their work environment, the work that they do, and ultimately their passion and experience with the concept of neurodiversity that could mean so many different things to different people. And that is why we love bringing them on the show and finding out what it means to them. Today, I have the wonderful Alice, who comes from an experience I had recently, being invited to Bocconi University in Milan. And what an experience that was for me. As somebody who bombed out of school, what a pleasure to go to such a wonderful elite university to talk about my passion. So I'm now going to hear, and we're going to hear, and have the pleasure of hearing from Alice's experience. Alice, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Very nice to be here.
Oh, such a pleasure to have you on. Tell people about who you are, what you do.
Sure. So I am Alice, which is basically the Italian for Alice, just to make it clear to everybody listening. I'm 29 years old and I'm a researcher at Bocconi University right now, where I am working on this super exciting project that is at the frontier of economics, demography, and also health sciences, where we analyze the effect of childhood disability on other family members. And I've only recently joined this project in September, but this is my life now. Yeah, so I'm very excited and happy about it. Other than that, so I have a PhD in economics, which is a very tough experience we're going to talk about, I guess. And what else? I'm a musician. I'm a songwriter, so that's also a very important part of me. I think as a quick presentation, that is all.
Wow, lovely. And already you're just dropping in some lovely nuggets of life experience and achievements there. Already I'm like, wow, you know, you've achieved a considerable amount, but the best is yet to come. I can sense it, Alice, from this incredible work that you're getting involved in. Just tell us a little bit about the early years of Alice then. How does somebody get to do a PhD in the work that you've done and then get to be involved in this research work that is it's topical. It's of a period. It's now, right? Which is really fascinating for me. How did you go on that journey? What did the young Alice look like?
Okay, so I think this answer is going to take us the whole hour. So let me jump straight into the negative side. Basically, the way I've become the person I am now, and also what you were saying, that these are all like, they look like huge success, and they are indeed. But this is because I've always lived in my brain. And let's say that my brain power has always been my best, my best skill to introduce to the world and the way I could really, make myself interesting. I make strange faces. I fall down and I try to play sports. I suck at being physical. And so basically my brain has always been my strength. And even when I was very, very young, I very quickly learned that was the way I could also, be appreciated by other adults. So the fact that in school I was just so clever, always straight A's in everything I was doing, that was really, you know, the way to look successful. And especially when you're like a kid, adults seem to appreciate a lot when you're smart and doing well in school, which changes at some point. Like when I was in my 20s and I was still a nerd and studying all the time and very focused on my wannabe academic career, at that point people and relatives started saying, oh my god, but why do you study all the time, try to go out sometimes, have fun. Of course I hated discos, as you can imagine, since we're on this podcast. So yeah, let's say that it's been a bit of a ride in that sense. But let's see, so when I was a child, yeah, I was very brainy. There's also some negative sides to it, in the sense that since the very beginning, I was very aware of being sometimes quicker to understand things, and also that I had an ease of understanding structures compared to the other kids. So I was also able to be a leader in this sense. So even in social interactions, I would have this script. I knew exactly what they were doing. I could see it from the outside. In a way, I could be a manager. And that is how I managed to go through childhood, basically, without succumbing to this, you know, not understanding things from you know, in the first person, and just trying to see it from the outside. Always brainy. Brain was always my solution. Yeah.
Wow. So it sounds like you were controlled. If you could control the environment, control the conversation, control the knowledge, and always be at the front in terms of the expertise, that's where your comfort was.
Yes. So control mania, I would say, has been one of the main themes of my personal growth in the last couple of years. And it's definitely something I'm trying to get rid of, but it's also what really allowed me to do things until now. So when we speak of successes, it's because I've been pushing myself so hard, even when it was painful, even when it was not okay for me and was causing me, you know, physical problems, from migraines to all sorts of infections, because, you know, my immune system was getting weak from so much effort. So control mania, discipline, bam, bam, bam. I was my own, I don't know, military general, trying to push myself to do things. Yeah.
But there was a cost, yeah, is what we're saying. And the cost is that by doubling down and going as deep as you can go in terms of knowledge and expertise and managing yourself into the ground, you weren't then looking after your own mental health and well-being from that perspective, and knowing when to take breaks, when to relax, when to put on the brakes and say, enough's enough for the moment.
Exactly. So I remember, for instance, my, like, the first years of university, where I would have these exam sessions every month and a half. And my life was study, 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 don't fall behind. And then exam week, huge, massive anxiety, like no one else around me. Then you take the exam, and the day after, I would literally have migraines so strong that I would vomit for 2 days straight. And that, to me, was normal. And people around me, of course, at that time, I had no idea I was neurodivergent, right? So I was basically seeking treatment for migraine with neurologists. And all that people were able to tell me was, well, you have to relax. Like, what the, you know? That's the worst thing you can tell to anybody who has this kind of issues, because, well, help me understand what's the deep underlying cause. So, yeah, that was the cost that I was paying, really. And now I'm slowly learning to take my own time, understand when I need the time, because that's also the problem. Like, I wasn't really understanding when I needed a break, and I wasn't able to let go. I think I've had my first experience of letting go of something like 2 years ago. I was 27 years old, and I realized, trying to meditate basically, that in my life I had never let go. I was always controlling, even when I thought, okay, I have to relax. That was, again, an action of control. I was telling myself, now is the time to relax. You know, robot. That is not relaxing at all. It's actually the opposite of relaxing, no? So, yeah.
Interestingly, the migraines Do you get visual aura with your migraines?
Yes, I get all the possible symptoms. Yeah.
And do you have you found that they've been relieved by, or do you still get them dependent on a situation?
Well, now, lately, I have to say I'm getting them less and less. I've had only one very bad episode with a visual aura last year. But that was because I was taking a medicine that was actually, causing the migraine. So that wasn't really. But in terms of managing my life in order to avoid them, I'm doing really well. So now the very bad episode with the visual aura, as soon as I get some symptoms, I know. Well, actually, I'm able to realize myself now when I'm getting to a level of, you know, tension that could develop into a migraine. So I stop myself before that point. But if I get any signs of the very, very, you know, light feeling that the world is a bit more blue than usual, then at that point is that is when I stop. Because before I used to have massive visual distortions, it was like, I don't know, some, crazy, drug-like, feeling drunk, and everything was getting circles and blue bubbles and horrible sensation, really. Like, I've been to the ER twice thinking I was going to have a stroke. Yeah.
Wow. Wow. So let me just unpick some of that. Before we go on to talk about the experiences of working within academia and the journey to the role that you do now, let's think about where was the point then, the realization that there's something different happening in your brain and possibly that it may be aligned to autism, ADHD, or whatever else that may be, but there's a neurological difference going on. You're like, hang on a minute, this isn't a migraine in isolation. This isn't anxiety in isolation. This is something else going on here.
Right. So it went like this. So let me start by saying that even before I had any idea about neurodivergence, because as probably everybody else, I had the idea that autism was just, you know, the most severe levels of autism. So I had no idea about level one, which is what I have. But even back then, I had theorized that my brain was kind of a high consumption machine. So I could have very high performance in exchange of very high cost. So I needed to sleep a lot, like 9 hours per night, or I would get a migraine. I needed to eat well because any bad food would cause me a migraine, or like I was very selective in based on what I can eat and feel well about it or not. So I had this like personal theory in my mind about how my brain worked, but I had no scientific backup, let's put it this way. And then what happened is that, in the second lockdown we had here in Italy, I started getting hugely depressed. And that was because the medicine I was taking for the migraine, given to me by the neurologist, was an antidepressant. And at some point, the frequency of migraines was so high that we realized the medicine wasn't working anymore. And so I had to change the medicine. And the moment I stopped taking that antidepressant, I went into depression, of course. what do you expect? So then I started changing from doctor to doctor, and each one of them gave me a different drug. And each one of those drugs gave me awful side effects, really awful. I was having nightmares. I was fainting because my pressure was too low. Awful stuff. And then at some point, something completely unrelated happened, so which actually relates to academia. So this was during my PhD. And there was a person in academia that gave me some comments on my work. And the comments were absolutely correct and very useful, but they were given to me in a very blunt and indelicate way. And I was reacting very badly. Like for 1 week, I wasn't able to think of anything else or producing anything at all. And then it occurred to me, by thinking back to the, you know, to the modalities of this conversation, that perhaps this sounded to me a bit like autism. Like I knew something about autism. I thought, I know this person holds me in, you know, high esteem. So probably the bluntness wasn't really intentional. There is something there. So I started looking it up, like how can autism look in adults? And the more I read, the more I realized, wait, autism in women looks like this? This is me. So I had this massive breakthrough, and I started going into the loophole of research about autism. And then I contacted a psychiatrist, and she said, you definitely look like you might be on the spectrum, so you should do like an official assessment. And then it's very hard to do it in Italy because there's basically two places in the whole country. And so I signed up to do one. And after 1 year and a half, I finally got my diagnosis, which is level one autism and also inattentive ADHD. So this is, let's say, the entire story.
Wow. Incredible. Thank you. And so that's fascinating. And I'm interested in the perspective, the Italian perspective, right? So you mentioned there's only two places to get diagnosed and that it's difficult.
Mm-hmm.
What is the process? Is it difficult because of the time that it takes? Is it that there are now more people? Is it still not that widely known about? Is it still talked about primarily from a medical perspective? You know, just give me a little bit of insight into what it's like in Italy today from a neurodiversity neuroendocrine.
So all the things you mentioned are there, all of them. And there's also a lot of like heterogeneity depending on the region you're in, because in Italy, the National Health Service works at the regional level. So everyone does their own thing. So for instance, if you're from Bologna, there is actually a specialized center that also deals with neurodiversity in adults that is public. And maybe it's a bit easier there, but you need to be from the city of Bologna. So it's like, you know, so I'm from Rome, which is the capital, and it's a huge city. And, you know, provision of public services isn't always the easiest thing because we're so many and cuts here, cuts there. There's definitely a medical approach to neurodiversity. For example, my mom is a doctor, even though she's been working in the pharmaceutical sector for basically her entire career, but she's a doctor. And when I started talking to her about this, she was thinking that this is impossible, like autism is something else and blah, 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 super medical approach, super basically only autism level 3 is worth considering. And slowly, slowly, she started realizing what I was saying. And now she completely understood, let's say. But this is not to say that my mom understood. It's to say that medical doctors have no idea what we're talking about when we're talking about neurodiversity. And if you want to get a diagnosis, basically there's very few specialized centers, especially for adults. And I know of two mostly. And basically you have to sign up online and there is one doctor doing the diagnosis. So the queue can last up to 1 year, 1 year and a half. It's insane. They do a great service, by the way. And these are the people who are also mostly involved with the divulgatory efforts to actually explain to psychologists and doctors around the country what we're talking about. But it's definitely not enough. Yeah.
Absolutely. Well, thank you for sharing that specific perspective as well, because it's really interesting to hear, you know, how this narrative is evolving. And it is evolving rapidly in different parts of Europe and the world, but it has its nuances based on the infrastructure. Please go on.
Yeah. Actually, let me add something. So there is this online group of people on the spectrum that I'm part of, Italian group, right? And there's actually a lot of stories of people who get misdiagnosed in very bad ways because they maybe, when they start developing mental health issues as a consequence of being on the spectrum and they go to the public service for mental health, what happens is that they get all sorts of diagnoses and they're wrong and they get, you know, medicines for the wrong stuff. And this can, or even they go into like psychotherapy that doesn't really work for them and it's treating them for something that doesn't exist. And this causes just huge amount of damage. And even when these people realize by themselves that they're on the spectrum and maybe get the diagnosis privately, they are not believed. So you get health professionals actively contrasting a diagnosis from someone who's specialized because they just deny the existence of neurodiversity the way that we know it, that we're talking about. Yeah.
Absolutely. And we see that across other parts of Europe as well. The misunderstanding, the misdiagnosis, mm-hmm. the the misrepresentation, and especially, as you mentioned, amongst women and girls. Things like eating disorders, for example, where there's challenges around taste, texture, and smell. Well, if you don't want to eat something, because it's not just girls and women, but it's missed more in those, because the assumption is that it's an eating disorder rather than it's a preference for not eating something over something else. And the impact of the socioeconomic background, whether you've been privileged enough to be offered different types of food, can impact on how much you eat, the variety of what you eat, the way it impacts on your health and well-being. So there's so many factors that come into play that can have
and
a negative impact.
Sorry for interrupting. The connection was a bit off. No, but consider that in Italy, we have this huge culture about eating, right? So it's all about cuisine here. And so especially the people on the spectrum that appreciate industrial processed foods because they're always the same, they're very safe. For them, it's hell, because basically you would get your grandma, why aren't you eating this? This is so good. Why don't you throw this? This is so good. Like for me, it hasn't really been that much of an issue because I love food. But for instance, I completely hate seafood, all of it. And it's considered something absurd because seafood is, you know, it's the most expensive. It's the very nice food you can get. So for me, every time there's like, I don't know, a wedding where people or something very nice and elegant where people want to offer you seafood, it's a nightmare. There is only one place in the entire country where I do eat fish. And it's by the seaside where I go on holidays with my family. And I've always been there in my summer since I was a kid. And these people know exactly the way that I eat fish. But any other place, I tried getting exactly the same dish somewhere else. I hate it. I cannot do this. So there's also a bit of stigma, I think, more than in other places in Italy for not eating everything, for not appreciating cuisine. Yeah.
Yeah. And I was only just sat at a table having a conversation and thinking around the impact of our unique, wonderful brains, dependent on your background, where you grow up. And I was just thinking around the Italian culture, and I've traveled across all of Italy. I had my honeymoon in Sicily. I love Italy and Italian culture. And I'm just thinking, for some, the very open nature, the very direct nature, the kind of the way that people express themselves, even in Sicily specifically, driving in roads, very expressive, even in the cars. and I just think actually there's some of that can be really good for certain brain types, but also I could imagine it could be really overwhelming and the in your face bodily contact. I know we were only discussing it around the table.
Noise. Noise is awful. Like, honestly, for me, I hate it. I said, I love food. I love going to restaurants. It's one of the things that I share, for instance, with my partner. We love going to restaurants and trying food wherever we go. And one of the things that annoys me the most is people sitting at the next table and just making noise. Because it's not like a decent level of volume for a conversation. It's really, an exaggeration, and for me the overstimulation is constant, but it's the same when you're in the streets. I mean, now I'm living in Milan, which is slightly better in some ways, but I'm from Rome, right? So Rome is very messy, so the amount of people that are just honking or just shouting sometimes at each other, it can be very, very stressful. And for me, the problem, I have a huge problem with sensitivity to noise. It just distracts me completely. So I've started living my life with earbuds, noise canceling, earphones, all this kind of aid. But at the same time, it can get dangerous because if they're honking at you, because, so I must say, in Milan, the situation is much better. The more you go towards the north, the more it resembles London, but we never get to the London level. For me, London, for instance, I realized that for me, it was really paradise. Because you go, walk in the street, everybody's following the rules, and then you look down and they tell you, look right, look left, you know, people are really not accelerating just for making noise, which is very common in Italy, like people just, you know, showing off their ego with their engines and so on. And these are things that I can imagine my Italian friends maybe listening to this podcast and thinking, what the hell is she talking about? It's not that bad. And probably it's just because they don't realize, like, we don't live on the same planet, 100%. Yeah.
Wonderful. And so again, thank you. I find that fascinating, and really appreciate you sharing your personal experience from that perspective. Now, let's look at that then in the context of academia. Think about some of those experiences, some of those challenges, how you've been able to go from, and I think this might be a big jump for a lot of people, to go from being, for doing the PhD, which is doubling down in some of those areas where you're best, but where also it has created some moments of crisis for you, to translate that into a research academic role within a university environment, and share some of the opportunities, but also some of the challenges that exist within that environment.
I'm sure I'm going to get distracted and forget half of the things I want to say, but so I'll try to go in chronological order. So let's say that I've decided to do a PhD precisely because I wanted to end up in academia. And that came from the realization that any normal job was not for me. Like at the end of my master's, I tried doing, but just, you know, to see how it went, I tried doing the selection for a couple of banks because I have a master's in economics. And that was, like, honestly, I knew I was very smart, very able to do whatever job they could have given me. But, you know, those horrible tests that they, for me, that's just overwhelming. I cannot do this. Like my inattentive ADHD is just killing me. And also the amount of anxiety that this timed whatever crazy quiz is where I cannot prepare, I don't know what to expect. Of course, I failed them horribly. So, and then I realized there's also other parts of, let's say, normal jobs that for me weren't doable, such as dressing up nicely. And especially I have to say in Italy, there is a bit more demand on that side if you want to stay in this country. So in many occasions, women who do not wear high heels are not that fine, or at least you need to be, even if you're not wearing heels, which to me is complete torture. I cannot do it. I completely deleted them from my life. You need to be dressed up nicely enough to be part of the environment. And for me, that's just overwhelming and unacceptable. And it's just, you know, limitation of my personal state. I cannot. So I just said, I'm not going into the private sector, even though in terms of skills, I think I could have done it perfectly. So then I decided to go into academia because I'm also very curious and I loved the idea of doing research and also researching things that, you know, are really my passion. So alongside the work that I've been mentioning on disability and these more demographic things in my previous work and what I'm also like, I keep doing, of course, because I need to publish it. I'm working a lot in economic history, and history is one of my very deep special interests. During my PhD, I've had the occasion to spend 3 months studying the archaeology of a river in Italy using sources that would use Latin from the 13th century, even though I was doing a PhD in economics. And these are the joys of academia. There is no other research job in any private institution that would allow you to do anything of that sort. And for me, it was a joy, of course. So that's how I decided to be in academia, that was my objective. And then basically I jumped into the PhD program. And that can also be very challenging in some fields, especially. So I did economics because of, I love when I was like, finishing high school, that's how I decided to study economics in the first place. I thought I really like history and social sciences in general, but I also really, really like math. I like the rigor. I like the preciseness, the very clear logic that you need to follow. So I want to use that in my life. And I thought, which discipline perfectly combines social sciences and math? Economics. And that's how I chose economics. In hindsight, I might have done something differently, but never mind. So, and then after making this choice, I was on a path. So for me, that was the only possible PhD program I could have ever done. Also, there is a lot of, let's say, I would say arrogance, actually, in the economics field towards the other social sciences, because we think we're methodologically superior in some way. And I have to say, in some ways we are, but the, you know, the arrogance and the way that we just, it's absolutely unjustified. And sometimes we are just crazy about those methods to the point of favoring methods over questions, which I think is completely stupid. But let me close this bracket, right? Because otherwise we're getting off to a tangent. So I went into this PhD in economics program, and to access this program, the competition is insane. So you need to take this horrible GRE test, which is basically those horrible tests we were talking about before, except you have the time to prepare it. And so I prepared, and in every simulation, I was getting like the top score. But then on the day of the test, you need to go to the center. They check all your pockets, and like they take it to, it's an American company doing this, so you can imagine the amount of absurdity. Basically, you can carry, if you do it in the US, you can carry guns, but not water to drink, like, honestly. And so you need to sit in front of this computer where you cannot adjust the light on the screen, and that already kills me, for 4 hours taking this test. You can only stand up to go to the bathroom and have some food once. Again, kills me. And so I took it twice, because the first time I got a score of 159. And I needed 160. Oh. And that time, yeah, I mean, I'm going to say something very, like, bluntly and absolutely. That time, I basically almost peed myself. And I was 25, 26. Like, this is torture. And they do allow for, you know, exceptions in the modalities of taking the exam if you have some medical certificate, whatever. But first, I'm not sure neurodiversity counts towards those exceptions. And second, I had no idea I was neurodivergent back then. So I only had a diagnosis for migraine, and that was not enough. So fuck me. So that was my first time, and that was trauma, 100% trauma. And I knew I had to do it a second time to enter the PhD program. So I did it again. I did it in Sweden, because I studied in Sweden for my master's. And there, the situation was slightly better. Even though absolutely not ideal. And there I got 163. So it was above the bar, even though, of course, in all simulations, I was getting 170, which is the maximum. And that was very frustrating. So, but when I got, you know, above the bar, I said, okay, that's it. I'm never doing this again. So I applied to the PhDs all around Europe. And I got into this program in Florence, where I've spent probably the best 5 years of my life, despite the huge amounts of anxiety. Because what happens, and this is really important, I think, when you decide to be in academia, all you know about academia is how it works when you study. So you know you have some objectives, they're clear, there is this exam, this is what you need to know for the exam, you study, you take the exam, you pass, we go on. When you pass from that part to the research part, you're on your own. Nobody tells you what you have to do. You have to come up with original ideas that are interesting to the literature, to the field, and you need to manage time by yourself. In some ways, you can definitely see how that's good for someone who's neurodivergent, because it means that I can function on my own hyperfocus and also rest when I am completely useless, which happens, like, this is my cycle of life, basically. But on the other hand, you know, some ADHD symptoms can make it really hard to go through your projects when you are in the negative mood. And sometimes the negative mood can be quite long. So that's challenging, definitely. And then I think another horrible, horrible part of it is the amount of competition and also the way that it works in the publishing process right now. There's a lot of talk, I mean, besides neurodiversity, but the system is utterly unjust. In the social sciences right now, there is a single blind peer review, which means when you have a scientific article, you submit it to a journal, And this gets reviewed by other scientists in your field, right? And what happens is that they know who you are, but you don't know who they are. So, of course, this creates all sorts of distorted incentives for them to publish only the people they like, the people that can. It's crazy. And as someone on the spectrum, you know, realizing it's unjust just makes my brain boil. I think you know the sensation when you feel the fever in your head, even though, do you know it? Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And then you realize, like, you've come from this career of taking exams, of passing tests, of passing reviews at the end of your second and third and fourth year of PhD. And then you enter this world where everything that ever will count for your career is publications. And the entire publication system is a mess. So that is very challenging, and I'm kind of dealing with it right now. Because you realize it's not only the quality of your work, there's 700 factors that have nothing to do with your, you know, with your abilities, and this can really hit on your self-worth. But then I guess when I talk to people, everybody's like, oh, but every job has its problems. Why do you whine so much? There is much worse things that can happen. I'm like, yeah, sure. But I'm just, you know, I'm saying this to make people aware of how things work in academia when you're neurodivergent. So yeah, positives and negatives. And the other thing I would like maybe to say is that, of course, precisely because there are many neurodivergent people who are very smart. And there's actually a joke I loved, you know, the whole fake story that vaccines cause autism. I've seen a meme online. It was so much fun. They said, well, actually, you know, very smart scientists, they're all on the spectrum. So actually, it's autism that caused vaccines. I loved it. Anyway, and then, yeah. So the thing is that it is true that many neurodivergent people are extremely smart. And if you are really passionate about your scientific work, it is your special interest, it's highly likely you end up being an academic in it. Especially because you don't want to be guided by the interests of industry. And so you want to be in a context where you can do research for the sake of research. So academia is full of neurodivergent people, but most of them are completely unaware of being neurodivergent. So what happens is that on the one hand, some, let's say, quirky neurodivergent behaviors are more accepted. But it's also true that there's conflicting needs. So, for instance, if you have rejection-sensitive dysphoria and you come across someone who gives you feedback in a very blunt way, you're going to die. Like, you're literally, you know, knocked out for 2-3 weeks. And nobody's going to say this is inappropriate behavior on the job, because in academia, things that are completely, you know, I'm going to say illegal, or at least they're sanctioned, they're punished in a private job. In academia, they are completely normal. So I've seen people running out of seminar rooms in tears after hearing the feedback of professors. And sometimes, you know, they really mean it to help you improve your work and the way you present, but the way that it's delivered is just awful. So yeah, it's positive on some sides, but it's negative on others. And I think it's especially bad for women, because neurodivergent women are just raised to be people pleasers, or at least I was. And it's not that I was raised to be a people pleaser, but I developed this behavior to adapt, to not be scolded every time, and so. If you are in such an environment and you really have to put up with very, very harsh communication styles, and academia is all about improving your work constantly. And so if people behave in these ways, it's, you know, it's a constant people blurting their frustrations on you. And so that becomes very hard, because at that point you either try to please these people to the point of annihilating yourself, and that's extremely bad for your mental health, or you have to react. And to be frank, I still haven't realized 100% how to react. So I'm still in this process. I've spoken for like 20 minutes. Was it clear? Is there?
Wonderful. Very clear. And what comes immediately to mind is the cost. So the cost of not understanding the impact that you may have on somebody else, the cost of giving very blunt feedback to what may feel like a life's work, or where you've given blood, sweat, and tears, and for somebody to dismiss it so for emotionally so easily, and the impact that that can have on specifically somebody who is autistic, ADHD, co-occurrence, and it is so significant, it could ultimately mean it's at the detriment of the quality of that work in the future, which concerns me, and I think this is probably relevant in history, that then if we have, dare I say it, neurotypical, or somebody who doesn't understand this neurological makeup, they're going to be subservient, override, delete that viewpoint from research, from academia, from history. And that is one of the fundamental problems that we have when we think about incredibly brilliant minds who ultimately get locked out of the conversation. So that's my immediate, that's what's going on in my head when he's mentioning all of that, is there's a real risk there that what we actually need is more academic rigor, research within the space of neurodiversity, neuroinclusion, the impact on the workplace, the impact on the environment, impact on the community, on families. All of these things are significant, and we need neurodivergent individuals to be leading on that research. However, based on what you're telling me, there is an absolute risk that they become deleted out of that conversation.
Yeah, or at least the thing is that you enter in this bubble where everyone around you has some, let's say, quirky behavior. No, this is how it's perceived from the outside. And so you think that's the norm, and you stop interrogating yourself, and you might never get diagnosed in your life and keep struggling forever. But let me also point out two things, very important ones. The first is that to all researchers listening to this podcast, don't steal the idea, because I want to be leading that research in the future. So I'm already thinking about stuff. second thing, some of these behaviors are very field specific. All my experience comes from the social sciences, and in particular economics, which is known for being, the other social scientists consider as a hellish in a way. So they know that we're blunt, that we are crazy about the methods to the point of making people cry, and they even make fun of us, let's say it. But there are I think these behaviors are present also in other fields, of course, but I must say, in my experience, sometimes I went to some history seminars, for instance, out of my sheer curiosity, because as I said, I love history. And there, the atmosphere was very, very different. And it was very nice. It was very British, let me say it this way. So even when harsh feedback was on the table, they said it in a super nice way, but also in a very, how can I say, subtle way that perhaps not every neurodiverse person can understand. So I think perhaps in the humanities it's slightly different, but also the type of research that we do is completely different. So yeah.
Absolutely. It seems that there's a balance between being clear, concise, to the point, but with care, with care and consideration of how that's going to be interpreted by the person it's being delivered to. And I think that balance is needs to be reassessed. And actually, the more I'm thinking there that it can, it potentially could be autistic minds, ADHD minds being locked out of it. Actually, no, the other lens to that is what you've mentioned there is, no, it could be one autistic person making the life difficult for another, for example, because They have a very clear way of the way that they see it, and therefore they're kind of imposing that on the next person, on the next person, on the next person. And that can almost close the doors as well to the thinking going outside of that very linear direction, which means you can go deep, but we need the ability to also go wide. And that's the diversity of thought. That's where it comes in and can be very powerful.
People pleasers will try not to upset them. So maybe they have brilliant ideas, but they don't bring them up because they don't want to upset this person who's so rigid on their own views. Yeah, definitely.
Interesting. It makes it for a complex environment, but one certainly, if we start to have the conversations as we're doing here, it creates understanding, empathy, appreciation, and then starts to bring down some of those barriers to go, okay, can we have some more open conversations and dialogues around what may be some of the personal barriers that may impact us being able to deliver this thing that we need to deliver as a group. I also think, and I wonder your thoughts here as we bring this to a close, and maybe this is also linked to what the future looks like. Specifically with COVID, and I'm not saying you're a specialist within that space, but specifically within COVID, when we have a global crisis and the barriers come down to academic rigor, research, which university has ownership, which region, which country, which, when those barriers come down because they have to, for the sustainability of human nature, the speed at which we move things is considerable. Do you also find that maybe there is something in that, in what you were mentioning earlier about being very particular in economics, for example, around the way things are done, the expertise, the level, but also the not sharing? How much of that do you think impacts on us progressing the narrative globally, but specifically also I'm thinking now about neurodiversity and neuroinclusion. And if we shared more research and insights and academic rigor, you know, across the globe, imagine how much further we could get more quickly from the old concept and style of thinking of autism, broken mind, to different minds.
Absolutely. So when I say that I want to do research on this stuff in the future, one thing that I have in mind is that it must definitely be multidisciplinary. And this is something that is always advertised as being, you know, the goal. Let's make multidisciplinary research because it sounds cool and founders demand it. But at the same time, if you really go and look at what people are doing, we hate it. Because mostly every discipline, even the disciplines that are very close to each other, are going to have very strong opinions about what's bad in other disciplines. But quite frankly, it's the only way. Like, we need to realize that different disciplines have evolved different methods because the questions cannot be tackled all the same way. And so if we want to really, make some meaningful research about neurodiversity, it must consider, of course, psychology would have the lion's share. But then we need to really understand the societal impact. So that goes into demography. For instance, let's speak about demography. The fact that we apparently choose each other, that's so important because it tells you that there are entire families that perhaps are on the spectrum or have ADHD or whatever. And that creates, different nuclei that are kind of choosing each other and only going out with each other and not really integrating well into society. So that's demography, for instance. It's a big question for them. It's economics because, of course, this speaks about the way that, we find jobs, we self-select into some occupations. Like I said, I decided to be in academia because I realized that so many of my particular bits were not fitting well with the private sector, even though I think I would have been a great manager, but never mind. So that's economics. And there's, of course, medicine that needs to understand. There's so many. So one thing I do, and again, this is because I'm interested in it, I actually look at the medical literature around, themes related to ADHD and autism And there is something going on there, but all the studies are very, very narrow. They are focusing on something very specific, like, for instance, let's say being on the spectrum and sleep disorders, and then being on the spectrum and the tendency to develop diabetes type 2. And then if you read all those papers, you kind of see that there might be a link that is related to the way your body is always in tension and the inflammatory status of your body. And, you know, if we learned to put these things all together and also link them to the external factors that cause the inflammation to always be high, you know, I think we should have kind of a holistic view of how this works. And all these disciplines need to talk to each other and come together and do stuff. So, yeah, this is what I want to do later in my career, but you are absolutely right that there is no way we can solve this puzzle and make it clear, you know, to the wider world if we do not integrate this different perspective. Yeah.
Incredible. That's wonderful. And just as we, the final piece of the conversation today, so what specifically now is your work? What are you concentrating on for the next 12 months? And if people do want to reach out to you and connect, how should they do that?
So I'm working on a lot of stuff. My main endeavors right now are related to the project I'm working on at Bocconi, where you met me first. And it's the work of, this was the original idea of Nicoletta Balbo, who is my VI. Let me also just say that I love her. I love everything about my job because she created such an inclusive and productive environment where, you know, it's a safe space and I can just express my creativity and also feel safe if some days I'm a bit off, which is definitely good for the productivity of the entire team because then, you know, we can adjust things. Nicoletta is incredible, and she won this huge European grant to study the effect of childhood disability on the life course of other family members, because they are often overlooked. So we are talking about siblings, parents, and even grandparents, who, of course, are massively affected, but most of the research is focused on the people who have a disability, which, of course, is relevant, but doesn't answer all the questions. Because perhaps, you know, a family that has to cut their income by 50% to actually attend to a person with a disability is also a family that might have greater issues accessing the right type of care. So this also reflects on the people with a disability. So I'm working on this project right now with a very different, you know, tangents coming up. So I'm working on this amazing project on the historical life expectancy of people with disabilities, looking at data from the 19th century. Amazing stuff being done, really. And then my work is also focused on, as I said, some economic history. So the long-term effects of institutions from the Middle Age on current political preferences. And this is something that I've been doing since my PhD. And there's also some work about basically how to change attitudes towards vaccinations using effective communication. So I'm running some experiments there on different types of population segments to see what works and what doesn't. And let's say this is it in a nutshell. Lots of stuff I realize it can be confusing. And then you ask how people can get in touch with me. So if you're interested, if you go on my website, which is www.alicedominici, I think you can read it somewhere in the notes to this podcast, .com, you will find there's my Twitter handle, there's my university email, you can find me there basically. And you can also read the abstracts and find the drafts of some of my work.
Brilliant. Yes, of course. They'll be in the notes, so you can click them there. Alice, a real pleasure. Wonderful work. So generous of you to share your journey, your experience within academia, the great work that you continue to do now, and a real pleasure to be involved for me in a small way. And I'm very excited by the piece that you're currently working on. I think it's so important. And again, it's an area that I think is massively under research. So there's going to be great value that comes out of that for sure. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you, Theo, for giving me the opportunity. It's been really, really fun and important to me. Thanks, really.
You've been listening to Neurodiversity with Theo Smith. Please do sign up, get involved, write some comments, give us 5 stars if you think you like the show, and do share it with others. We've grown significantly this year, and we would like to grow further and get out to as many people as possible. And by all means, if you want to be on the show, if you've got some ideas, please let us know. Also, sign up for Neurodiversity with Theo Smith on YouTube, and you'll be able to watch more insights, entertaining, fun, and great videos to help you within the workplace and within life. See you soon.